RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to get up to date and discuss the NZD SOS legal case against the Medical Council of New Zealand regarding COVID, on RCR this morning from NZD SOS, Dr. Alison Goodwin. Alison, welcome back. Nice to have you here.
Morning, Paul. Thank you. Yes, nice to be back again.
Doctor of over 25 years, initially working in emergency departments, then in general practice, last 10 years, so people know. And Dr. Matt Shelton. Hi, Matt. Good to have you back.
Hey, morning, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Medical doctor since 85, mostly in primary care and general practice. You've been a lecturer. Sounds like this is your life. You've been a lecturer and examiner in integrative medicine. This is your life. All right, good to have you both back.
Thanks, Paul.
And good to see you both, too, in Christchurch it was, for that leg of the two conference events, NZD SOS conference this year. So I know we're not here to talk about that. Maybe we can touch on it a bit later, but it was good to catch up with that and seemed to go pretty well, right? Went well, the Christchurch one anyway, I thought.
Yes, it was very good. Very good to audience and excellent speakers and, yeah, good all round and good feedback.
Yeah, and Auckland, that I saw a bit of the live stream. Looked like it was going all right.
Yeah, it did. We had an extra speaker to fit in. And it was a bigger venue, bigger audience, and you know, great atmosphere. And one of the great things is the intel. You know, people just come up and tell their stories. And we had quite a lot of stuff from people inside the health service, actually, that's fairly hair-raising, but we should be used to it all by now, I guess.
Oh, that's interesting. All right, to this legal case. It involves substantially two things, doesn't it? Guidance issued by the Medical Council of New Zealand and the ability of doctors like you guys to prescribe medicine. So does it boil down to those two things pretty well?
Yes, that's right. I mean, the main focus was the guidance statement that was issued to all doctors in April 2021, guidance about the COVID-19 vaccination. And then the second smaller part was, yes, about doctors' ability to prescribe off-label medicines. Ivermectin was the example, but just it was more a generic thing that we just wanted the judge to effectively uphold doctors' abilities to prescribe off-label medicines, particularly for long-standing, safe, approved medicines. We just wanted a confirmation that we were able to do that without interference.
All right. And the guidance was what and where did it come from? Do you know?
Well, it seemed to appear worldwide around about the same time, very similar wording documents to doctors, but also to other health professionals, dentists, pharmacists, midwives. I'm not sure, maybe the nurses probably got one. And basically there were three main issues or three things that concerned me. And the rest of NZD SOS with the guidance statement. First of all, it said that doctors had to be vaccinated against COVID-19. It said that that doctors must discuss the benefits of vaccines, and it didn't actually say anything about discussing the risks, and that is usually part of informed consent. And it said there was no place for anti-vaccination messaging, but there was not a clear definition of anti-vaccination messaging. So those were the three things that, unsettled doctors about it and, you know, what made us wonder, well, where does this guidance fit with the other medical council standards? So all doctors know that standards are things that we should adhere to and uphold. But this was a guidance statement and there was no similar document issued by the medical council. So doctors weren't clear, well, does this take precedence over the existing standards? Do the existing standards take precedence over this? Where does it fit in the great scheme of things? And individually and as a group, we had actually tried in 2021 to get some clarity over that unsuccessfully, I have to say.
So the medical council never made that clear?
No. When we wrote in November or October 2021, we had a lawyer draft up a detailed letter expressing our concerns about the nature of the guidance statement. And was it something that we were going to be held to account over? Like, was it something we had to adhere to? Would we get in trouble if we discussed the risks of vaccination? What did anti-vaccination messaging mean when for some people, the risks would outweigh the benefits. And we might say, well, actually, in your case, you know, we don't recommend you get the vaccine. So we were trying to figure out, well, are we going to get hauled over the coals if we say that? But we got just a half-page letter back from the Medical Council CEO, which basically said, just read the guidance statement. I'm not going to answer all your questions.
Because you can't talk about benefits if there are no known benefits, can you?
Well,
I mean, there weren't any known benefits that were proven or tested or anything. So there was that's an impossible ask.
Oh, well, I mean, you could have argued in April 21 that potentially there were some benefits. But, I mean, not to include discussing of risks is completely against all usual standards of the Medical Council and the usual requirements for informed consent, where you would have to discuss the risks and you'd have to discuss the alternatives. Like, what else could a person do? If they're not taking the vaccine, you know, are there treatments? Can they get natural immunity? How risky is the disease? What if they do nothing? You know, there's a whole lot of other things besides risks and benefits that needed to be discussed as well. But only benefits was particularly picked out as what needed to be discussed.
Has any guidance before ever included, you know, the doctor should be vaccinated?
No. So that was another question was, you know, is the Medical Council itself practicing medicine by making these medical recommendations? And I mean, they don't have a remit to provide medical advice. And that's effectively what they were doing by saying all doctors should be vaccinated. That's another question. Where was their authority to tell doctors what medical treatment they should get?
And no anti-vax messaging. Well, I mean, how do you even define that?
Well, that was, you know, I still remain unclear. I mean, it's more clear after the court case and one of the documents that was read out that Matt will speak about in due course. But anti-vaccination messaging, what does it mean? I mean, their evidence, their Medical Council and Dental Council was trying to say, well, anti-vaccination messaging is anything where you're opposed to vaccination. Whereas the way that the guidance statement was used was that anyone that talked about the risks of vaccination without necessarily being opposed to it, you know, that was taken as anti-vaccination messaging, just talking about the risks. Whereas, you know, a more formal guidance or a more formal definition of anti-vaccination messaging is something that is opposed to vaccination. And
And just back to the prescribing, ivermectin. Obviously, it's come out that can be quite beneficial. I mean, who makes a clinical judgment like that in the Medical Council? It's again trying to be some kind thing that they're that they aren't, right?
Yeah, well, that's not the role of the Medical Council to decide which medicines doctors do or do not prescribe. I mean, MedSafe regulates doctors to make sure doctors are up to scratch. Did I say MedSafe? The Medical Council regulates doctors.
Yep.
MedSafe regulates the medicines to make sure the medicines are up to scratch, and then the doctors make the decisions whether or not to prescribe medicines. So it's not up to the Medical Council to say you can or cannot prescribe this medicine for this person. I mean, if there is a situation in which they do want to do that, they have access to Section 48 of the Medicines Act, which enables the minister, presumably the Minister of Health, to prohibit prescribing of a particular medicine by a group of people or by a particular person. So they had a pathway that if they didn't want ivermectin prescribed, ivermectin or other medications, they could have got it restricted that way, but that didn't happen. They've just used their perceived authority to take to task any doctor that has prescribed ivermectin or helped somebody import it or spoken about ivermectin. And, you know, even if there was no evidence of its effectiveness, it's a safe medicine. It's been in use for decades. The risks were minimal with prescribing it. And so, you know, there wasn't much to lose if somebody wanted to try it.
Except that people might try that and not get vaccinated.
Well, yes, that seems to have been the ulterior motive behind it, perhaps.
Yeah, which you could argue is, well, maybe that will come up before a court one day, let's say. Matt, do you want to join in on this now and tell us?
I'm champing at the bit.
Okay, building on all of that, what you've learned, what has has become more clear in the time that this case has been going?
Well, for me, the money shot, I guess, if you like, with the whole thing for the 2 days was the last half an hour where this board member of the medical council, who had actually resigned in the end, he didn't want to get vaccinated, and they were pushing him really hard, so he resigned, and he gave an affidavit. So this is a sworn statement of truth in a court case. That really blew the lid on what went on in the medical council around the time that they were coming up with the guidance, and also how they proceeded I think, you know, he described it as a witch hunt, really, against doctors who disagreed with this. And here it comes. Most of the doctors thought that the vaccine was zero risk.
Zero.
Zero risk. So let that percolate. You know, I don't know that there's ever been a medical product that's zero risk, and even many stuff over the counter, you know, comes with a warning, even though it's not prescription.
So that would be a first. Zero risk would be a first.
Absolute first, certainly in my lifetime, and you know, everybody else who's sane and sensible would at least raise an eyebrow. But I think this is the sign of the kind of psychological capture and the political pressure that the, you know, the medical council was dealing with. So they, I can actually just read out a couple of the sentences from this affidavit, and there's an important point here, and that is that anything that was actually read out in the court from the submissions that had already been lodged, and that, you know, each side had seen, but anything that's you know, orally heard, is, you know, fair game for repeating and for discussing. You know, we have to do it with balance and fairness. You know, let me just read a sentence from where he's talking about, you know, contrasting his previous experience where they would discuss doctors who were in trouble or where there'd been complaints, to you know, what happened when people had complaints about the likes of us, who I will say were actually just doing the job that the medical council should have been doing itself, which was to get in the way, in between patients and this brand new product with no safety data, et cetera. So one of the things he said was, what alarmed me at the time was that the majority of medical council members were aggressive in their response to all of these anti-vax doctors, calling for harsh, vindictive even sanctions for even the most minor of cases. The usual detailed discussion of evidence and high-level legal arguments was abandoned. It was clear that most other members of the medical council considered that any doctor who so much as doubted any of the COVID pandemic directives should be heavily sanctioned and preferably suspended. So that's, it shouldn't be shocking, but you know, to have that, you know, clarified and confirmed from someone.
Sounds vaguely medieval. Sounds vaguely medieval, you know, with the pitchforks there and burn them, burn them, burn them.
Look, that's
how it felt. That's how it felt to us that were being persecuted. That where was the science? Where was the discussion? Where was the reasonableness?
And the medical council didn't present any evidence that was heard over those 2 days that they'd done any level of science review, of Bill of Rights assessment. You know, there was cursory mention right at the beginning of their communications around whether they should have a guidance document. And in fact, they all dismissed it, you know, as being, well, unreasonable and that they shouldn't go there. And then over 3 weeks, the tone changed. And these emails were read out, so I can discuss them. And I think during that time, probably our first open letter landed on their desk. And I suspect they probably realized that they might have a fight on their hands. And you know, by God, they were going to give us one. But I'm just going to read out also what this guy said here. So he says, there was general agreement amongst most medical council members that the COVID vaccine was a zero-risk medication and that doctors who thought the side effects risks were significant were woefully misinformed. The approach of medical council staff and most members was to rely on the guidance statement, which indicated doctors should promote vaccine benefits, not risks. That meant that a doctor talking about the risks associated with vaccination was a reason to take disciplinary action. With the exception of my contributions, with occasional support from one or two others, there was no engagement by the other members of medical council with the nature of informed consent, the doctor's code of ethics, or human rights more generally. When I asked one other member what they thought about submissions from one doctor's lawyer, and I suspect this was mine he was talking about, which focused heavily on the human rights aspect, they said they hadn't bothered to read them. I tried to get engagement with these issues during our council meetings, but it was my impression most members' minds were closed. So, you know, any right-thinking person should be absolutely horrified. And particularly those of us that put a lot of time into answering, you know, the charges against us and preparing for our PCCs, you know, to have it said that you know, they didn't even bother to read them actually reminds me of something that we'd already figured out for ourselves. And that is that some of our earlier open letters, and maybe some of our later ones too, that were addressed to the medical council, weren't given to the board members. So the chairman basically sat on them. And at one stage, we got a letter from the deputy chair saying that they weren't going to pass around our communication to the board. And that one was actually, we wrote a formal complaint laying out what we thought were the laws that the chairperson had broken and the way the medical council was conducting itself, and asking that the chair should resign. So, you know, we weren't surprised that we didn't get engagement. But in fact, with that letter, they did refer it to the Ministry of Health, because although the board generally supported, well, they said that they supported the chairman, we had raised issues of governance, so it did need to go to the Ministry of Health, and it disappeared, and we never got anything substantive. But just to come back to this zero risk thing, if the medical council, which is probably regarded as, you know, the highest authority, the most senior regulatory body of healthcare workers in the land, you know, if they just pluck this zero risk thing out of the air, you know, at a time when overseas pharmacovigilance systems were already screaming from the rooftops in countries where the vaccine had been rolled out before, so the UK and the US.
Israel.
And in fact, if they checked with CALM were already receiving some reports from the border workers, who were the first group to start to be jabbed. If they'd done just the most basic literature review, if they'd looked at how the vaccine worked and what the ingredients were, and looked at, you know, what were already known to be problems and dangers with some of the components, you know, then this zero risk thing would have been chucked in the bin. But the fact that they came up with this, and they still, to my knowledge, have not formally stepped back from that, you know, and yet we've had, what, four deaths that the government has acknowledged, and there were nearly 70,000 reports to the CALM system before MedSafe actually took it offline in December 2022. You know, they can't expect people to give them any credibility. But more worryingly, you know, what are people in the police and the army and in all these businesses and the other, you know, healthcare worker groups supposed to think? Because all these places would have taken their cue from the fact that the medical council had said to doctors, there is zero risk. It is only upside for this product. And you can't talk about the downsides. Now, this aspect in the guidance that doctors should stick to evidence-based information, I beg your pardon, and promote the benefits of vaccination. And I thought that was an interesting juxtaposition that they you know, that made both those statements in the same sentence, was actually challenged also in the board members' statement. And it was the right time to do it just before the case had finished, because previous to that, the medical council's barrister had said that statement, that doctors should stick to evidence-based information, of course it could include any negative information or cautionary information, if there was any. I think he bunged that in as well. I can't remember clearly.
If there was any, okay, yep.
At which point the judge piped up and said, well, if that's the case, then doctors who are being, subject to discipline for breaching the guidance, all their cases should be dropped, surely. Hmm. So there was silence in court for a few seconds while everybody digested that. But the point is, with this judgment, it could be months away. We don't actually know how much of the evidence the judge will factor in producing his finding. But, you know, even if we don't win the case on the sort of the legal technicality, that is all we can challenge, you know, the right of the medical council to produce this guidance statement, which they acknowledged, you know, wasn't a standard, which has a higher requirement for consultation and things. But they've certainly proceeded as if it was a standard. We've shown and uncovered, I think, some very important things that people need to take note of. And just to sort of segue into the conference, one of the themes was people being empowered, with knowledge, with information, with skills and strategies for being able to have discussions and connect with people. But more importantly than that, you know, every person who's awake to what's going on needs to be their own leader. And they need to figure out, you know, how they themselves are going to be part of putting all this right.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like if you've never done guidance like that before and then suddenly you're doing it with such a level of confidence in the face of no information, the consequences that could befall anyone who went against it and the natural justice, obvious natural justice implications of that, there could only be one thing, right? Is the dumb guy on the street's view? They were heavied. They were told to do this. Because it's part of the messaging required to get people to line up and take it. They needed to have the medical council taking a certain position. And I guess we need to know, maybe we will, maybe we won't eventually, who was told what when that was being set up.
It certainly wasn't unanimous, Paul. The voting statistics were read out in court, and there were 13 medical council members, and six of them voted in favour of the final form of the guidance.
Yeah.
But six didn't. Four voted against it, and two abstained. So although it was 6-4, the chairman at the time, Curtis Walker, added his own chairman's vote. I guess to get the
what do we know about number. Him? What do we know about him?
Well, he was slated fairly early on to take over the Maori half of Health New Zealand, which I don't know if you remember, but that was one of the things the Labor government.
So that was pending during COVID or in that time, was it? Do we know?
Yeah, we learned fairly early on that he'd been shoulder tapped for that. So, one could wonder, I suppose, about a conflict of interest.
So he didn't want to lose the job opportunity?
Well, look, I've got no idea, but he certainly...
No, I know, but you know how humans work.
Yeah. He certainly heavied doctors. You know, if only 5 or 10% of doctors had said right at the beginning, you know, we're not having this, injecting this into pregnant women, we don't know anything about it, it doesn't have a track record of success... there were already questions about the manipulation of the statistics from the approval trial and muddying the waters between the relative risk reduction, which was only 0.84% reduction in COVID cases in the vaccinated group.
Absolute risk reduction, 0.84.
I can't believe I got it wrong as well. But yeah, it's an important difference. But what she said. From 95% effective to 0.84%, you know, using the same results. I mean, this is an example of drug company marketing, and it seems that the medical council and everybody else fell for it, and they were just so desperate. But, you know, to come back to your point, you know, heavied, as Alison said, lots of medical councils came out with very similar wording around about the same time, and we've done a lot of work to... you know, try and expose the influence that the Federation of State Medical Boards in America has over, you know, all the American states, but other medical councils as well. And our CEO at the moment is serving on there as the chairwoman of their international arm, which does oversee, Australia and Canada and the UK and America and Ireland and things. So it's all quite kind of global, I suppose, in its origin, but we can only shine a light and challenge what's gone on here. But we need everybody to do it.
So you don't quite know how long this will take to work through at this point now?
No, they didn't. Or the judge didn't say when. He just reserved his decision.
Okay. All right, anything more to say about that? Because I want to ask about fluoride as well. Is that a similar, kind of a similar thing?
Well, I just had another point about the science and assessing the science. So it was said that somebody from the Dental Association did actually ask the Dental Council, you know, who was assessing the science that was backing up their recommendation that the vaccine was safe and every doctor should take it. I mean, I didn't hear that there was an answer to that, but there was no similar sort of questioning from within the medical council. Like, there was no acknowledgement that somebody should be assessing the science and checking that what they were doing was actually evidence-based. You know, and discussions too about the definitions of, I mean, I think we've already discussed anti-vaccination, but also misinformation. That word was bandied about in the court a bit without a sort of clear definition of, well, who decides what's misinformation. And again, the definition of evidence-based, you know, we had pounds and pounds. We had heaps of evidence that kilos. We were providing, but nobody was looking at it and nobody was considering it. But ours was scientific evidence, a lot of it in peer-reviewed journals. But, yes, who decides what is evidence-based medicine? You know, those, are, I guess, are still outstanding questions.
And to not read your correspondence.
Yeah, I mean,
I'd want to know what I'm dealing with. So I'd read them whether I was felt like I was in for a good ride or a bad ride. I'd be reading them because I'd want to know, but to not read them?
As Matt said, we'd put in hours, if not days or weeks, of blood, sweat and tears writing those, writing the reports back to the medical council, explaining, well, this is why I said that and this is why I was doing that and here's the evidence for that statement and here's the evidence for this statement. And then to think that that was wasted time and effort and energy.
Disrespect.
You know, that's a bit dispiriting.
Yeah.
You know, disrespectful on their part.
Matt, go.
Yeah, look, it is. But there's this sort of theme that we all know runs through, all parliamentary bodies and government things, and that's this plausible deniability. You know, don't ask, don't tell thing. But, you know, there is a duty. And a kind of, it's a legal rule of thumb, I suppose, on people like the Medical Council and Dental Council. And that is that they've got to make fair and reasonable decisions and judgments based on the information that they have available. And that's the bit where we feel, you know, we've done our bit in making sure that we've stuck all of the important information under their noses, under the noses of MedSafe, the politicians that we've got the ear of. The Ombudsman, Human Rights Commissioner, you know, Uncle Tom Cobley and all has been getting our letters for months and months, for 3 years now, and the MPs. And we know that some of them have been read, and particularly if you send a registered letter and you know it's been received, then you know, in law, even if an EA chucks it in the bin or something, they can't say that they haven't, that they haven't had it. We think that there is... very wobbly ground that these board members must feel that they're on. And although some have left, and there's a new chairperson, you know, we're still asking all of these people to sit down and engage, you know, so we can start to kind of, bring this thing, slow it down, bring it to a halt and start pushing in the other direction. Because the scale of harms, you know, it's beyond the ability to cover it up or to hide it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can try not to give it oxygen and you can deny it, but we're not going to be able to repair the health system and actually help the particular harms that there may be from the jabs until there's an acknowledgement that there's a problem. You know, we can't fix this, you know, in down dark little alleys, you know, worrying about what might happen to people, you know, who are trying their best to help. You know, we need to use the medical system that exists, and we need to get everybody on board, and we need to confront the reality of this dreadful, dreadful mistake. And that's being polite. And there'll be many people involved in this, you know, who have made mistakes. And all right, with maybe terrible consequences. But, you know, we have to confront what's happened and get an agreement that we need to move ahead and worry about the who did what to whom and who knew what when, you know, down the line. Because, you know, it is well known within the health system that there are problems. And I had a number of very powerful conversations in Auckland, you know, with clinicians who are confirming what we all know, which is that they know what's going on. But they were hamstrung by the guidance. They feel they're in too deep. You know, they've got their own personal sort of limitations as to what they feel they can do. And it still falls on, you know, our elected leaders, you know, and the non-elected, very well paid, you know, bosses of all the various departments that have responsibility for this, to say, well, you know, we were misinformed. We thought it was zero risk because the highest council, medical council on the land, you know, took that view. But, you know, doctors have responsibility too, because they outsource their own critical thinking and their own due diligence to this guidance document, assuming that if the medical council had looked into it, then it must be fine.
Yeah. Even though it defies common sense of the average person. But okay.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
All right. Time is tight. I was just thinking with what's been happening with fluoride that there's a kind of similar pattern at play here too, in a way. Am I right?
Yes.
Well, there certainly is. There certainly is. It's the same overwhelming strength of evidence that there's a problem that's being ignored, and people are in jeopardy, and their rights are being ignored. They're being mass medicated by what is, you know, overwhelmingly proven to be a neurotoxin. It just is, you know, and this isn't a sudden discovery. You know, people, not including me, have been bleating on about this accumulating evidence for decades. And yet there's been a deafness. And you know, we're talking about this kind of naked prosecution of blunt force by the authorities for no other reason than because they can. But we know it's not that. There's obviously money at stake. And there are obviously industries that would have to pay for remediation if they couldn't chuck it in the water. And essentially what's happening is this toxic waste is being put in the sea. It's ending up in the sea because it's being put in our waterways, and only about 1% of the fluoridated water actually goes through humans. But, you know, but that 1% is demonstrably dangerous. And you know, fewer and fewer countries are still doing it. So it's basically America and Australia and New Zealand, pretty much in the first world, and I think Ireland, about the only countries left. And I suppose it's got to go somewhere. But it's been breathtaking to sort of, again, see the way that the establishment responds or doesn't to hardcore, solid scientific information and public concern, you know, and mounting public concern too.
Late last week, I spoke to the Tauranga Mayor, Mahi Drysdale, about this and mentioned the US evidence, and that was before the Cochrane material was available. But I put it to him that how could he tolerate in any way, shape or form having this stuff go into the water supply of his citizens and not try and stop it? And I know that he was conflicted, but I think this is what we've been talking about, the psychology of it. He said there were liability issues and there could be personal liability issues sheeted back to councillors and council staff.
Surely there's liability as well for the damaged baby's brains that will ensue.
Yeah, you're old and grey. The person's old and grey by the time that gets anywhere.
Well, yes, probably.
So what you're saying before, Matt, people are going to have to be pretty strong about this. Otherwise, like I say, he didn't want to do it, but he wasn't saying, no, over my dead body. He didn't say that at all. He said, well, you know, if they make us do it, well, that's what we'll have to do, kind of thing.
Well, the ideal has been always that we on the ground by being locally active and being in touch with our local representatives should always have had a say in all of this stuff. But this has been the unmasking, I suppose, the ugly side of democracy, which is that, you know, lobbying and special interests are always operating behind the scenes. And it's very clear that this is about money. But you've got a whole bunch of people who've made their careers, you know, in dental health, singing this same message. You know, and doctors have got the same thing to confront too, going ahead, you know, on a number of issues. You know, these things have come out of nowhere, or we seem they have. They seem like they have, and we don't question who ever checked, you know, that it was okay to put fluoride in the water, the second most toxic metal on the planet, after plutonium, which is mercury, you know, into people's mouths for 150 years. I mean, you don't find much of that about anymore, you know, but and you won't find in 10 years' time, you won't find a dentist who ever thought that fluoride was a good idea. But at the moment, we're still dealing with the dogma and the groupthink. And meantime, as Alison says, you know, babies are getting brain damage. And that's what it amounts to. This isn't just a few IQ points. It's global neurological damage that will affect every aspect of that person's, you know, functioning, not just their intelligence, but their mood regulation, their decision making, impulse control, you know, all of this stuff is up for grabs to the mining industry, because essentially anything that digs rocks out of the ground produces fluoride as a byproduct. So it's not just about superphosphate fertilizer. And of course, remembering the agrichemical companies are essentially just a sidearm of the pharmaceutical companies. You know, it's all the same shareholders.
It even goes back to the same guy, Ashley, doesn't it?
Well, you can say that. We can't possibly comment.
Okay, well, he ordered that. He's gone now. I think he's in a mindful organization that does mindfulness. you can't write the script. But, you know, it's interesting when I say patterns and people. Same people are cropping up, same way of doing things.
Well, it was his very last act before he left was to you know, get all these councils. There's a list of councils. And the first tranche got the letter from him saying they had to fluoridate by you know, X date. And a judge said, well, he should have done a Bill of Rights assessment. And his the person that took over him hasn't done one either. And she can't say she doesn't know about all the reviews and the court cases. And things in the States, you know, and even the US government's acknowledged that it's not good. She can't pretend that she doesn't know about that, and yet she still seems to be sitting on her hands.
All right, we're up against time. Any final words before we end this chat, which people I'm sure will write in and comment on?
Yeah, well, the live stream from our conferences, our conference in Auckland is still for sale. So if people are, you know, curious about what was said, and there was some fantastic presentations, there really were. Just jump on our website, and I think it's good to go till the end of the month. You know, there's some really good stuff there.
Oh, there sure is. Yeah, I got to interview some of the speakers too, and that was a great experience here. Alison?
I guess just an encouragement for everyone just to keep talking about all these issues so that they don't attempt to be swept under the carpet. We just must keep communicating.
Okay, well, let's see what happens, and if there's any update, we want to hear about it. That is the NZD SOS legal case against the Medical Council of New Zealand. And again, thanks to Dr. Matt Shelton and Dr. Alison Goodwin for coming back on RCR. We'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.